My name's Anton Capel. I'll be chairing the session this morning. Our speaker is John Nichols, and the topic, as you can see on the screen, is investment guarantee product risk management. I'll start by reading John's bio. John Nichols is a senior consultant with Tillinghast based in the Melbourne office. John joined Tillinghast in 1990 and has travelled far and wide during his time with the company, working for 4 years in each of the US and Brazil. John's experience covers asset liability modelling, option pricing, financial reporting, mergers and acquisitions, and product development. A few examples of recent project work John has undertaken includes pricing of investment guarantees for companies in Australia, evaluation of the cost of options and guarantees of a company's participating business, application of variance reduction techniques to analyse and project the cost of options and guarantees of a company's participating business, and providing advice on AIFRS reserving and capital requirements for investment guarantee products. So I think John's well qualified to talk on this topic. He does have a relatively short presentation pack to go through. I'm not sure if you've all had an opportunity to read through that yet. There are quite a few slides showing graphs of sort of capital outcomes under different scenarios that John will obviously be talking to, and it might take a few minutes to get your heads around what you're looking at. So please feel free to ask questions as we go through the presentation, and then we'll certainly have time at the end for extra questions and discussion. So I think with that, I'll hand over to John. Sorry, one final point. I don't believe we have a roving mic, so for those who need to ask a question, please do come up to the front and use the mics. This one, unfortunately, is connected, so I can't pass it around the room.
Thanks, Anton. Been looking at a few things today. What we'll start off looking at, just having a look at what are the investment guarantee products. When we do that, we'll look at some actual products from around the world, from the US, Europe, and recent product from Australia. Then move on to look at the risks and the risk management, and then towards the end start looking at the sort of capital considerations. You know, obviously, if we're taking on risk, you know, we need capital in terms of managing that business. So first of all, the products. I think we're probably all becoming a lot more familiar with these terms now. The sort of product we're looking at under these investment guarantees is where we have a set of investment funds and overlaying some guarantees on top of those funds. So the sort of things we're looking at, the guaranteed minimum death benefit, accumulation benefit, the income benefit, and the withdrawal benefit. Kind of alongside those particular guarantees, though, there's various sort of levers that we can play around with to sort of differentiate our product from another. That might be, for example, the inclusion or not of ratchets or roll-up sort of features. Type of product. A few of the slides have a reasonable amount of information, and I'm not going to sort of go through all the detail. What I've tried to do is just capture some of the key elements of a number of products. So the first one is a US product from AXA Financial. Some of the sort of things we can see here is this product covers all the different types of the GMDB or the guaranteed minimum guarantees. So there's a guaranteed minimum death benefit, there's an income benefit option, there's an accumulation option, and also a withdrawal benefit. One of the benefits we'd note would be kind of GMIB, and that's, or sorry, GMDB, where we'll have a benefit that's offering a greater of a ratchet or a roll-up. And those two elements in this case actually work quite independently. At any point in time, we'd sort of ask the question, if I'd had a ratchet in place from issue, what benefit would have generated? If I'd had a roll-up from issue, what benefit would that have generated? And the final payout would take the greater of those two at any point in time. Which one is the greater, that might change. That would depend where you are and what the performance has been. Kind of for simplicity, I've shown a roll-up of 0%. In effect, that option is just a straight ratchet. The 0% roll-up is a kind of redundant element. I've just included it there to complete those options. The investment choice, they actually have a choice of 76 investment funds that they may be able to invest in. And there's quite a lot of flexibility. There's no real sort of limitation around where they invest in those particular funds. However, depending which of those actual guarantees they choose, their access to those funds can be greatly reduced. Kind of the minimum, and I think this is if you have a GMAB with 125% level, you're actually really down to only three investment funds that you can actually invest in with that if you choose that guarantee. Okay. Next product from Japan. I think following the US, Japan is probably the market where the guarantee products are most developed. Sales have really taken off in Japan since 2002 when banks were allowed to start distributing these products. The example we have here is a product from Tokio Marine, 3-in-1 product. And I think where the 3-in-1 name comes from is in terms not so much of the GMD bear element, but in terms of, say, the GMAB, GMIB element. Really, there's three conditions that my fund performance might meet over the life of this product. The first is that at outset, I specify a target fund level. Over time, the performance is such that my fund balance actually exceeds that target level. As soon as that happens, so long as I'm past 3 years of policy duration, I get an option either to take that fund value as a lump sum, or I can take a deferred annuity certain. It's really no guarantee there. It's just your fund's performed well. Here's two options for you to consider at this point in time. The other two conditions really look at what happens at the end of the investment guarantee period. And there's two conditions there. One is that the fund value is actually greater than my guarantee level. At that choice, you're then given the option, again, take a lump sum, or in this case, take an immediate annuity certain. Again, the fund value is greater than that initial contribution level. There's no real payoff from the guarantee. Where the guarantee comes in is in the third state. And there, you've got a mix of an option either to take a lump sum benefit or an income benefit that has a guaranteed minimum. At outset, you can certainly look at this product and know when my investment period ends, I can get an annuity for 15 years, absolute minimum, 1/15 of what I paid up front. Unlike the US product where you had 76 funds to invest from, there's really no investment choice with this product. They take your money, invest it in a particular predefined way. The other thing to really note, there's really just the one structure of the product. The US product, there's all sorts of different options that you could choose from. Here, there's kind of the one defined structure. Next, from Europe, it's the Aegon 5 for Life product. In terms of market development, certainly Europe is sort of lagging behind US and Japan, but we're certainly starting to see more products come through in the European market. Similar to Japan, the structure of the product is much more well-defined. However, you do get a lot more investment choice. I have, in this case, 55 investment funds that you're able to choose. Although there are certain restrictions about where you place those investments. For example, I don't think you can place any more than 60% in equity investments. The different sort of exposure to equity investments gives different level of charges. If you're at the maximum of around 60%, the charge would be 150 basis points. If you have lower exposure to equity, obviously you're going to get a lower charge, maybe down around the 50% level. Late last year, we have a product of this nature introduced into the Australian market, the AXA North product. Similar to sort of the European, Japanese product, it has a relatively fixed structure. The benefits that you get are quite well defined. Principal element, I'd say, is really the GMAB element. So you have capital protection over the life of the guarantee period, which you can choose. To some extent, there's also a death benefit or withdrawal benefit, but that's the extent you can get a partial payout of your guarantee benefit if you die or if you want to withdraw your money before the end of the guarantee period. But really, the fundamental benefit would seem to be really the GMAB. If you're taking the guarantee option, you have access to over sort of 40 investment funds. But in this case, you then choose from three investment strategies, and you have to stick with that strategy over the life of the guarantee. That said, I think you can have very high exposure to equity investments among those sort of three investment strategies. Just a couple other points. It's a product officially, I guess, issued by NM Super, the super trustee, with the guarantee underwritten within NMFM. when it comes to capital considerations, that's something that could, well, particularly regulatory capital consideration, that could be of importance. A product, you know, written in a sort of investment company where the sort of life company regulatory capital minimums are not going to apply. It's not going to change, say, the economic capital, what the capital really need to have in relation to the business, but, you know, certainly affect potentially your regulatory capital that you're needing to hold. Even looking, you know, just at a few products, we can kind of see even with a small number of building blocks, we can get a lot of variation, a lot of different features getting built into these different products. Had summarised some of the charges for those different products on the previous slides. Typically, those charges are not guaranteed, although, you know, they may be changed. There is, more often than not, there's going to be some sort of maximum level that they can change up to. I don't think anyone's going to be too interested in taking out a product with a guarantee if you turn around and tell them, by the way, I can just change and charge whatever I like. The other element, you know, there's always some form of investment restriction, although that can vary in how that's applied. You know, in the US product, they certainly restrict the funds you can invest in. AXA North, they both restrict the funds you can invest in. If you didn't have the guarantee, you'd have access to about 100 investment funds. With the guarantee, that reduces about 50. But there's also they layering investment strategies over and above that choice of fund in case of the North product. Turn now and start to, you know, think about some of the risks associated with these products and then, you know, the management of those risks. What I'm presenting here is really, you know, what is sort of one way of summarising the risks that an insurance entity would face. You know, and this isn't specific to the guarantee product. You know, this would be kind of a general sort of picture. Obviously, there's other ways you could classify risk. You know, I'm not going to say this is, you know, the only way and not necessarily totally stuck to this. In terms of financial risk, you know, I have separated to some extent the market risk and credit risk. Although really as we sort of move forward, when it comes to the credit risk, I'll be looking more at credit risk from the point of view of managing, say, a hedge position or reinsurance position. Within that risk, you know, we can certainly identify, you know, a number of risks where an investment guarantee product is going to, where that risk is going to be particularly significant. A number of these are not significant in terms of the guarantee product. And, you know, highlighted, you know, some of those here. Not surprisingly, you know, pretty much all the market risk is really going to present, you know, a financial risk to the provider of this business. I perhaps could have also added concentration risk, but to some extent the concentration in the underlying investment assets, that's a risk borne more by the policyholder. Concentration risk would perhaps more come under credit risk if I'm, you know, using one reinsurer or one provider of managing the guarantee. But to some extent, yeah, that also goes along with the counterparty risk in terms of the credit category. Insurance risk, I've sort of highlighted two, longevity and withdrawal. Typically, yes, there is a death benefit in the product, so there is mortality risk, but typically the mortality risk is fairly small. If there is longevity, that's more of a concern, certainly the mortality element. Withdrawals, that's be one of the most more difficult areas to control. The policyholder has an option whether or not to continue with that. That's very hard for the provider to have a lot of control over. And finally, we'll look more at, you know, operational risks. For the most part, you know, these risks are not going to be unique to guarantee products. You know, people risks apply, you know, for any sort of product. Introducing a new product will present, you know, additional challenges, particularly in these operational risk areas. Okay, so now spend a bit of time, you know, looking at the risk management of these. First area we'll look at financial risk management. Slide I've reproduced here, Zach. Obviously, you know, I think the methods and the tools for managing the financial risk are, you know, quite well known and certainly increasing. You know, at one end of the extreme, you know, is the option to stay naked. Be taking on a lot of variability in terms of your balance sheet and results if you were to choose that. So then some of the other options of sort of moving through static protection, what would be common for major riders, having some sort of internal dynamic hedging program in place, and then outsourcing the risk, whether that's someone else to take on the risk or formal reinsurance to take on that risk. And the final element, at the end of the day, I'm still going to have some risk that I'm retaining as a rider, regardless of which approach I'm taking, and need to hold appropriate levels of capital in relation to that risk. We'll look more at capital later in the presentation. Obviously, which approach is really most sensible, it's going to vary. It will vary on a case by case. As I say, a larger company may have the resources and head towards internal dynamic hedging. A smaller company may not actually want that risk, but want to offer the guarantee as a means of generating more investment business. So the particular solution will vary depending on the circumstances of any particular company. One of the things we really want to do, though, is understand what the risk is, whether we're going to keep that risk, hedge that risk, reinsure the risk. We really want to understand what that risk is. What is it we're keeping? Also, what is it we're giving away? I think really to understand the risk, and we'll look at some examples in terms of capital, is you have to do some analysis, no way around it. Do some stochastic analysis. Even some stress analysis can provide a lot of useful information. Hand in hand with the risk is, if we're keeping the risk, we have to have a level of capital. But our capital resources are limited. So we can't just say we're going to take on this risk, hold all this risk. We have to look at it in terms of what's the available capital and make the decisions to sort of best use what that available capital is. Ultimately, the third element of the equation will be, what's really the value that we're actually adding to the business? Sure, I could take on the risk, I've got unlimited capital, but is taking on the risk actually adding value to shareholders? So ultimately, we need to do that analysis, not just in terms of understanding the risk, but looking at the total picture of the company, the risk versus the capital that you're employing to manage that risk, and what's the value that's being generated for shareholders. Really, that's the key to understanding the financial risk. Often, when we sort of look at that financial risk, we focus on what's easy, what's more well-known. In looking at the particular financial risk, yield curves, how they change, equity prices, how they behave, property in FX, we're probably a lot more accustomed to looking at those risks. We'll be reflecting that in our stochastic simulations, for example. But there's a lot of additional risk that we should not be ignoring. Volatility. There's certain models out there that are available. We can also, as we're doing our stochastic analysis, quite readily extend and allow for the impact of volatility and understand that risk as part of our analysis. Liquidity and counterparty, perhaps not as easy to do as, say, volatility, but I think to make some sort of allowance, some sort of heuristic allowance for what in analysis, whether it's a stochastic analysis or a stress analysis, would be reasonably straightforward. Would not be that difficult to, in terms of counterparty, say, if I've had a big movement, reflect a larger probability of default in my hedging program or in my reinsurance program. If I've had a large movement in terms of liquidity, can I rebalance my portfolio as quick as if I'd only have a small movement? Something that you could quite easily build in heuristic allowance into any modelling, even if those allowances are sort of difficult to validate to the market because of lack of data. Similarly, in terms of basis risk, in terms of the basis risk, really looking at difference between what's happening on my investment side versus my, say, dynamic hedge side. The movement in the price of my hedge is not going to be perfectly aligned with what's happening on the underlying investment. And again, that's something that we can certainly make allowance for that in our analyses. In terms of the operational risk, and trying to get through this fairly quickly, as I said, the operational risks are not unique to investment guarantee products. for example, looking at people risk, you know, they're going to be the same sort of question. You know, do I have enough knowledge of this in the company? You know, if not, can I perhaps outsource it or use reinsurance to cover that shortfall? If we are doing it internally, you know, and you know, we face the risk of the people with the knowledge leaving, you know, do we have the tools to get other people up to speed quickly and so forth? You know, these are not new challenges. Okay? It's just a new area where we have to make sure that we're ready to you know, move quickly and make sure that you know, we're in a position to sort of cover those circumstances. You know, do we have backup if someone's going to take holiday? You know, make sure we have a reasonable level of knowledge. If we don't have it internally, can we get it externally? You know, similarly, you know, processes and systems, you know, managing and setting up processes and systems, you know, there might be new systems, new processes that are required, but the risks around those, you know, very similar to you know, a lot of the other systems, unit pricing, for example. We need to make sure everything's working accurate, it's going to be robust, have all the appropriate checks and balances, make sure we've got all the responsibilities. We know who's going to be running this process. We know who's going to review the results, who's going to sign off on it, who's going to implement the actual transactions, etc. Make sure we're able to sort of deal with both events that we can expect. You know, if someone's going to take holiday, we have someone else to step in. Also unusual events. If there is a big market movement, you know, do we need to review our hedge position during the day? You know, think about that up front and you know, be in a position such that you know, if that is that large movement, you automatically know and kick off the process to go and do that. One of the key elements really in terms of processes, though, is making sure things are going to happen on a timely basis. Very often the investment products are not internal, but there might be external products. You're not going to know the actual unit price for today for a particular fund until 2 or 3 business days' time. So in terms of implementing a hedge, you know, that's information that's not coming through on a timely basis. So really would need to be building into our process some way of estimating what that end of day position is. You know, we know what the exposures are. You know, we know what the market movements are. You know, we can make approximate you know, estimation and build that timely process such that our hedging is working on time. We're not always waiting for information from third parties and playing catch up. Pricing risk, new product, you know, additional pricing risk. But no different sort of situation to any other new product where we're introducing something that's new to the market. We would have faced this in terms of sort of you know, dread disease products, for example, when they were introduced. If we don't have local experience, there is international experience. Of course, we have to use that with caution. Coming back to the analysis, though, you know, if we have you know, good analysis, we can use that to sort of understand the risk around these sort of unknown elements. I have one point here just to make sure everything's consistent with actual product conditions. It sounds pretty obvious. We did actually look at a product, investment guarantee product, in Asia where they'd priced assuming a 60% exposure to equities, 40% to fixed interest. The product didn't actually have any investment restrictions in it. People could invest 100% in equity. Don't need to guess what's going to happen. You know, what did they do? They went and invested almost 100% in equity. Obviously, they totally mispriced that product because the analysis and the assumptions they made are not consistent with what the product actually said. And then finally, while we're doing that analysis, we can look at alternative product features, you know, what's going to be best from, to some extent from the point of view of the policyholder to the extent from the point of view of the company as well. You know, should we have a ratchet? Should we have a roll-up? Should we you know, not bother with those elements? But when performing that analysis, taking into account, you know, again, looking at the risk, you know, what's our capital we have available, and you know, ultimately making sure you know, we're adding value to the bottom line. As I said, you know, one of the things when we're looking at the risk is also to understand the capital and turn now and have a look at that. I've got a few charts, fortunately, they're of generally of quite similar structure, so if we understand the first one, you know, the rest will follow quite quickly. So looking at and taking an example, a fairly simple product, just a 5-year GMAB, guarantee return 0% with an annual ratchet for the most part. For comparison, you know, do also look at the example without the annual ratchet. And when I change there, you know, there is obviously a change in the charge for those guarantees, presenting a different level of risk. From the risk management point of view, we assume we're actually hedging the sort of delta, rho and vega elements. And for the personal analysis, I'm looking at, well, what's the capital required in terms to balance a particular set of stresses? So a 25% fall in equity, fall in the yield curve, 200 basis points, increase in the volatility, also a change in my withdrawal rate. So at the end, I'm saying, yeah, if I take that capital plus the asset supporting the policy liability, this stress happens, I've still got then enough assets, you know, to match my stressed liability. Effectively, I'm also assuming that capital is invested in cash. So, you know, I apply the stress to the asset supporting the capital, there's no change to the value of those assets. So what does the result actually look at? And, you know, first of all, before looking at the features, explain what it is we're looking at. On the sort of left-hand index, we're looking at, well, what's the required capital level, and I've expressed that as a percentage of account value. And so, yeah, the percentages here are ranging from zero sort of up to 12%. I'm looking at that, how that varies with moneyness, and moneyness I'm considering as a ratio of what's my account value to my level of guarantee. In this way, it's actually over here to the right, the option is out of money. The option's in the money, the lower that ratio. So on the left-hand side, the option would be in the money. You know, my account value's fallen relative to the guarantee level. Other element we're looking at, how that varies by policy duration. So, you know, midway through the first policy year we have at the front, moving through to midway through the last policy year. To some extent, you know, so it's kind of a saddle shape, but really to understand where that shape's coming from, it's really worthwhile to, you know, look at the components, what are the different stresses and what are they contributing to it. So just sort of move on and look at, well, what's the different components and how have they contributed to this capital requirement. The first one to look at is the price movement. And you can certainly see some elements of that sort of complex shape in terms of the price movement. Certainly falling off on the extremes, whether we're in the money or out of the money. But very much a peak where we're near the money and actually increasing quite significantly as we're approaching maturity. The peak's really coming about because of the non-linearity in what's the value of the option versus the movement in the assets. You know, the hedge for large movements, you know, doesn't move in the same way as the value of the assets supporting the business, giving rise to a significant capital requirement there. One thing to also to keep in mind, while this might be a 5-year GMAB, you know, if I issue a 10, 15-year GMAB, eventually it will be a 5-year GMAB. We're still going to get to that, you know, back end of this contract. However, as a portfolio sort of approach, I'd have business, you know, early in duration with lower capital requirements. It shouldn't necessarily be that my capital is going to shoot off to that high level on a portfolio approach. So we can certainly see part of that complex shape through the price stress. Next, interest rate stress. Fairly uninteresting. You know, the movements in interest rates are quite well hedged. There is a small capital requirement, but you know, it's not generating the main elements of the risk of the capital. Similarly, the volatility movement, you know, which is in this case hedge, you know, very, very small contribution to that capital requirement. So the last element of the stresses that we've looked at is really the lapse stress, and this is where the other major feature is really coming from. If the option's early in the money at early durations, you know, movements in my sort of lapse experience, they're going to have a significant impact on the value of that liability. If the option's out of the money, you know, fairly small impact. I might lose out on some fees, but there's no real major movement in that liability. Keep in mind that if you have, essentially for the risk we're looking at here, this is the only risk that we've not hedged in any way. So this really flows straight through to the structure we have here. But in terms of looking at that, you know, looking at those individual stresses, we can sort of understand, well, you know, what's really looking and driving potentially the capital, you know, given where we'd be in terms of moneyness and how that might change over time as we move through the life of the policy. We'll come back to this shortly. To some extent, you know, that's not really going to tell me how much capital do I need to hold, because, you know, I don't know where I'm going to be in terms of that moneyness. That's going to be, you know, I may be in the money, might not be out of the money. Potentially I might have to hold a lot of capital, but, you know, it's hard to say. I don't really know from that. We can sort of repeat the analysis, and this is now where we're looking at, it's the same analysis, but, you know, there's no ratchet in the guarantee. But that we actually come up with a very similar structure. I'll put them up sort of side by side, make it easier to sort of compare. They're not quite aligned as they should have been. But, yeah, without the ratchet, you know, we have a much lower capital requirement here where we're near the money. When we're actually out of the money, now we actually need more capital than if we actually have the ratchet, which is a little bit surprising. If you think about what's going to happen with the ratchet, you know, whatever that account value is, you know, at the end of the year, that's going to get locked in you know, to the value of that option. So any movement in that account value is going to have a reasonably linear impact in the liability for that guarantee if I have a ratchet. So I actually get, you know, a lower capital requirement where I have a ratchet if the option is out of the money. So it's a little bit surprising. Also makes it more difficult to sort of say, well, you know, on a dollar level, which would require more capital? You know, very hard to say. Okay. So sort of moving quickly, we can then sort of extend and look, do actually a bit more stochastic analysis and say, well, we know the account values are various, so let's look at some sort of stochastic account values. And presenting here now is a distribution based on some real-world projections of what the account value might happen. It's a projection with lapses, so if we look at the median, you know, that's going to drop down over time because reflecting lapses over time and showing, in effect, you know, the 5th, 25th median, 75th and 95th percentile distribution of account value. Then really building that in and overlaying with those sort of capital requirements, we can then get a picture in sort of dollar level, what's the actual capital, distribution of capital that we can expect to need to hold for that business. Whereas my early on, my account values in the median might have been falling, you know, my capital requirement actually goes up, you know, because of the interaction of, you know, that complex shape with the account values. We can do the same sort of analysis, I'll just skip one slide, in terms of business without a ratchet. Yeah. Distribution of the account values, capital level, even without looking at side by side, while those two shapes were quite similar in structure, not dissimilar in level, the picture of the actual capital requirement is very different. So building in that stochastic element of what we expect on the account values with what we expect on capital levels, we get a very different picture for these two, with and without the ratchet. So I kind of skip on, and we can see that with them two side by side. The distribution of account value is very similar. Without a ratchet, it's a little bit higher because I have lower charges. Then when it comes to capital level, you know, I clearly have a lot lower capital requirement without a ratchet. Yeah. You know, the last comparison we can look at, well, what's the distribution we're actually expecting for the that capital ratio that we'd summarised in the chart? Where the big difference is really coming in is really in this lower end. Without a ratchet, we get a lot more business requiring a lower capital requirement. And that's what's led to that much lower dollar sort of level of capital without a ratchet. Now, this is really just one element of stochastic analysis that can perform. Also, caveat that in terms of looking at risk, you know, I've done what I said you shouldn't have done. You know, I've ignored a lot of risks. You know, I haven't done anything in terms of basis risk, counterparty risk, but, you know, it wouldn't be difficult to incorporate allowance for those risks in this sort of analysis. Really, to conclude, just talk just a little bit more about capital. In terms of looking at capital, you know, I've looked at just the impact of one particular sort of stress type analysis, you know, maybe not inconsistent with life insurance regulatory capital requirements. See, when we do look at capital, there's actually a lot of questions we have to ask ourselves before we actually even go off and do the analysis. And, you know, they're going to be like, how are we going to define the risk? Are we going to look at risk over a one-year period, look over the whole life of the policy? What's our risk measure? Is it like a probability of ruin measure, tail amount at risk, or tail variance? What are the risks that we're going to cover? Yeah. Clearly, in the simple analysis we've done there, we haven't covered all the risks, you know, but we know that. We're making conscious decisions about that. What's the impact measure? Yeah. Is it regulatory gap? Some sort of economic capital? And then how are we going to bring it all together? So when it comes to capital, you know, there's a lot of other questions we have to look at before we go and do the analysis. Yeah, I've talked too much, so that's Anton's fault. Please, if there are questions.
Okay, as you can hear, we've got 5 minutes left. So if there are any questions, please come up to the mic.
Yep.
Hey John, it's Zach Roberts. I've just got a question about the volatility shock you put in there.
Yep.
I think it was 2.5%.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really tied to that at all. If we look at what's happened over the last 6 months, we could say that's quite a small shock.
Yeah, I was about to say, you've had sort of plus 10% increases and we haven't had a equity market fall of 25% yet.
Yep.
But my sort of main question was, I can understand that if you're volatility hedged, that doesn't have an impact on the value of your guarantee, but are you able to go and say, okay, to maintain that volatility hedge position, if I have to keep paying away much higher volatility levels, what type of impact does that have on my sort of monthly profit? Because you're not receiving more from the policyholder to pay for that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, as I say, this is just really one element of the analysis we'll be doing. In terms of looking at value, we'd be doing exactly that. We'd be looking not just at the capital requirement, projecting out, you know, given changes in economic conditions, including the change in volatility, you know, what's actually going to be our profit on a monthly basis, you know, taking into account transaction costs, you know, all the costs and, you know, difficulties of managing the business. We'd be projecting out and looking at that in terms of what's the value, ultimate value.
Do you have any other questions? Oh, I do have one, which is, I don't know how much you have sort of inside knowledge, but to the extent that you can enlighten us on what you're aware of in other markets, like particularly the US and Asia, you know, given what's gone on in the markets over the past sort of 6, 8, 12 months, how have companies who sell this sort of business, how have their risk management practices stood up and what have they done wrong?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can put in huge amounts there, but I think, you know, the sort of things we're really hearing is what companies are doing in terms of particularly financial managers is largely hedging, particularly the delta and rho risk, and haven't been hedging volatility. And we all know what's happened with volatility. There's been, you know, a huge increase in volatility, so a lot of the companies have taken a hit. If they haven't changed their approach now, we'd certainly be thinking that, certainly be thinking about that going forward in particular. In terms of sort of the everyday, have there been liquidity issues, counterparty risks? You know, I'm not aware of any, but certainly the lack of a hedge of volatility is certainly... companies are going to go and rethink their decision not to hedge volatility.
Any other questions?
Hey John, just a quick question on a slightly different tack. Clearly, hedging and managing the risk side of this is quite complicated. Do you see companies selling enough of it to make it worthwhile from the company's point of view? So can you make this actually profitable for shareholders?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the answer is yes. Otherwise, we wouldn't all be talking about that and looking at these products as part of this conference. There's certainly other papers, including Zach and myself and Patty Brennan looked at the convention last year. They're really set for an explosion in the growth of superannuation products. So there's certainly going to be opportunity for this type of product in managing that investment risk and giving an underpinned guarantee to the levels of income or guarantees to the level of investment performance. I don't recall the exact statistics, but certainly the volume of assets that people have and are going to be looking at protecting their income is going to be grow substantially. So I think there's certainly going to be risk. Is every company going to be able to make a go of it? Probably not. But there will be companies that certainly do.
Okay, so we might wrap it up. So thanks for those questions. And thanks, John. If everyone can join me in thanking John in the usual way.